I'm searching through these documents for the history of my race, hoping to organize the information before it disintegrates into a chaos of dust. We are a race of monsters, recently created, so our history is short. I'm reading the writings of our founder, a Prussian scientist who drew up the plans for us in 1882, but our race did not come into being until nearly a century later. The name of the scientist was Augustus Rank, and he conceived the idea of a race of super-intelligent dogs with artificial hands and voice boxes to be used for military purposes, and devoted his life to creating them. He was fascinated by prosthetic devices, the possibilities. Many hideous animals were made before we were perfected.
That's Kirsten Bacchus reading from her novel Lives of the Monster Dogs. The book came out 20 years ago, and it's been a sleeper cult favorite ever since. And it's just been reissued, so if you missed it the first time, here's your chance. So who or what are these monster dogs? That's just what Doug wanted to know.
Kirsten, where did the idea for your novel Lives of the Monster Dogs come from?
I've always been fascinated by humans' relationship to non-human animals, and dogs in particular, in that kind of tragedy of their position as citizens of our world. You know, they're not like cats, where they really do very well living on their own without humans. Mm-hmm. They sort of need us, and yet they're not part of our world. They're treated as property in our world, and they're not valued. So that situation was always very compelling to me. So that's part of where it came from.
My favorite character in the novel is Ludwig von Sacker, and he's a black German shepherd who wears glasses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a bit about him?
Yeah, he's a very melancholy character. He's trying to record the history of the monster dogs. And he's trying to understand sort of where they came from or what their purpose is. He's reading Rank's diaries and trying to understand what his purpose was in creating the monster dogs, and what their purpose is now that he is gone and they don't have a leader anymore. And at the same time, his own consciousness is sort of disintegrating. Something is happening. Mm-hmm. To him and the other dogs mentally, they're having memory lapses and lapses back into dog-like behavior. And so he feels himself fighting against the loss of his own mind and sort of racing against the clock to try to get their history down and try to understand what he's here for. Before he loses his mind.
Yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Lives of the Monster Dogs, and appropriately enough, an excerpt from Ludwig's diaries.
They live like famous people, keeping away from crowds and employing others to do their shopping, occasionally appearing on talk shows or writing autobiographies. They are well received by fascinated audiences. But they aren't aware of the mixture of amusement and revulsion people feel at the sight of pinschers and Rottweilers stepping from a limousine, dressed like 19th century Prussians with their monocles and parasols. They look like ugly parodies of humans, and their biographies read like social satire. They will never be seen as anything but caricatures of human beings. There's no place for monsters in this world. That is why I prefer not to live with them. But of course, there's no place for me here, away from them, either. Standing at the window, leaning on my cane, it's not comfortable for me to stand unsupported on my hind legs. I can see the humans walking their dogs. There's a small, cold rain, almost a fog, and I'm holding my pince-nez in my hand, so they appear to me as vague shapes under the street lamps, fuzzy around the edges, as if they're disintegrating. The dogs that live around here are small, and they smell of nervousness, stupidity, and shampoo. I feel no kinship with them.
While I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think of the famous expression, man's best friend. Dogs are often considered to be men's, we should say, and women's best friends. But in Lives of the Monster Dogs, man, in the form of Dr. Augustus Ronk and his assistants, is really a dog's worst enemy. And you explore a lot of themes about the ways we mistreat dogs and other animals. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible what we do to other non-human animals. I don't know where to start with it. I was vegetarian starting when I was a child, when I was 11, because I sort of realized that meat is animals and I didn't want to eat them. And we have such a strange attitude towards them. You know, we'll do things to a pig that if somebody did them to a dog, everybody would be calling the police. And yet it happens on a massive scale every day in animal agriculture to animals that we don't consider as worthy as dogs for whatever reason. I mean, you know, and then we make up reasons like dogs are smarter, but they're not smarter than pigs, or, you know, they can't feel pain anymore or less than pigs can. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, we just very much use animals. You know, the bottom line is that we like to have dogs around our house and it's inconvenient to have pigs around our house. So it's kind of all about us. And I think that's slowly changing. I mean, it's changed hugely in the years since I wrote Monster Dogs. And that's very exciting for me to see. So I think the tide is turning, but it's hard. It's hard to see ourselves in others, especially in others who can't fight back and don't have a voice of their own, you know?
Yeah. As you say, the tide is turning. It's a slow turning. It's not turning as quickly as we would like it to, but at least it's turning in the right direction.
Yeah.
The idea of animal intelligence looms large. What does animal intelligence mean to you?
Well, you know, that's such an interesting question because we always measure their intelligence against our own, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they can figure out what we're saying to them, we think they're intelligent, but we don't measure our intelligence by whether we can figure out what they're trying to say to us. You know, what does that mean? I mean, each creature has an intelligence that's suited to who they are. And, you know, of course, we judge everything on a scale that puts us at the top and ranks everything beneath us.
Sure. The way we humans think is we automatically assume that our way of thinking is superior to an animal's way of thinking. And we don't necessarily know that.
Yeah. I mean, what does it mean, superior? I mean, if we're the ones who define what superior means, then of course ours is going to be superior.
Yeah. The fact that these monster dogs have this extra intelligence, the questions related to animal intelligence were something you were grappling and working your way through while writing the book, right?
Yeah. I mean, definitely that was something that was on my mind. And I mean, I think in the book it says that their intelligence is enhanced. And I think that thinking back on that now, I would ask myself what that means. Like, it was altered in some way to be more human-like or more adapted to living in human culture, you know.
So have you come up with an answer as to what it means all these years later, how their intelligence was enhanced? Or is that still a mystery to you?
I guess that's a mystery. Dogs are already so tuned into humans. I mean, they're basically psychic because that's how they live. That's their livelihood, is figuring out what humans want from them. But, you know, would they, like, reading? I don't know. Some dogs can read. I mean, I've heard of a couple dogs that you could write, you know, a short word on an index card and they know what it means. Like, you could write sit. There was one guy, Daniel Pinkwater. He had a dog, Lulu, who could read. That's the one I'm thinking of, actually. And she could say her name, too. She used to say, Lulu. Yeah.
You do a magnificent job of inhabiting the emotional and the psychological reality of what it might feel like to be these monster dogs, these dogs that have human hands and enhanced intelligence and are able to speak. I'm curious about how you were able to do that. Did you try to think like a dog or even like and take that a step further and think like a monster dog? How did you get inside their heads?
You know, I've come to think it's kind of a mystical process. I mean, there was part of me that resisted looking at it that way. I sort of wanted it to all make sense and to have some rational way to explain it. But it's, you know, it's art, and there's just spirit involved in it. I mean, part of it is you somehow invoke some consciousness that isn't yours and reach out to it, and you honor it, you treat it like it's real and it becomes real to you in some way. I think that's part of the process. And, you know, whether that's a person who's different from you or a creature of a different species, there's some element of channeling it in there, I think, of something that's not, it's not within the bounds of your normal consciousness and who you are. It's just a little bit outside of those bounds, and you have to reach for it and find it out there, I think.
Yeah, it seems you have to reach even further, though, when it's, as you mentioned, like when it's a different species and a species that has had these horrific acts performed upon it to modify it and make it more human-like. It seems to me you've got to go even deeper into your imagination.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, the other thing is that we here are humans judging how well I did at capturing a dog's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if a dog would agree.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you know what I'm saying?
Like, is Lulu still around? We got to call up Pinkwater and get Lulu to read it.
Yeah.
And offer a review. So one of the things that I find incredibly poignant and heartbreaking is that the monster dogs know that they're going to die. And as far as we know, regular dogs don't know that they're going to die. So it raises the question, is it better to be aware of the fact that you're going to die at some point? What do you think?
I don't know. If we could know the date and manner of our own deaths, would we want to know it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know the answer.
No, I don't think any
I guess
of us
it
did.
Would vary.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Was this idea that the monster dogs are aware of their mortality, was that something you thought about? Did that inform the way you wrote about the characters, the monster dogs, as they were getting ill towards the end of the book?
I mean, it definitely informed how I thought of their situation. I mean, I guess I felt that they were, that they were creatures who had limited time, and there was something unnatural about their existence, something wrong, you know, I think that, and that kind of is part of why they couldn't last. They weren't really meant to be in the world in a way.
Yeah.
They weren't, you know, they were neither dog nor human, and they had been changed from what they were supposed to be. And so I think that sense of them not being able to hold on to the world definitely was part of what I was feeling as I was writing the book.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why the whole novel, but especially the ending, the last few chapters about why it resonated so strongly with me, because it's a sort of like a universal existential question. And for an outsider like myself and someone who struggles with depression a lot, that's something like I often feel that I'm not meant to be in the world. So yeah, that was really well done.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of temporary for all of us, right? It isn't right. There are always things wrong while you're in the world, and ways that you don't match up with the world that you find yourself in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's almost like a universal feeling, I think.
Yeah. Towards the end of your story, the monster dogs start to become ill, and since they're unable to reproduce, that means that their kind is going to die out. And it's very, very poignant and very sad. And now would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from a scene in which Cleopyra, your human character, is talking to the monster dog Ludwig after Ludwig has become ill. Could you read this for us?
Sure. Okay. Okay, this is Cleo talking to Ludwig. Are you afraid of the future? I asked him once. We were sitting in his kitchen at a low butcher block table drinking tea. An assortment of huge pots that hung from the ceiling, little used now, gave a gentle coppery tint to the dim afternoon. I don't think so, he said. I expect it will be a welcome release. What will? Whatever comes next. There are still so many things to do. I should like to write extensively about Ranxir's with his followers, for instance. How he obtained and kept their loyalty. There are papers I have hardly looked at, which might shed some light on that question, and I think that would be quite interesting. But at some point one wants to be taken away, to feel a hand on the shoulder and hear, "Come, you have done enough." Don't you agree? But you don't have to wait for somebody to say it, I said. You can always stop working on one thing and do something else, can't you? No, I must keep working on my project. But you are young. Not so incredibly much younger than you. Ludwig's mouth opened in a slight smile and he shook his head. The scientists in all their wisdom were not able to slow down our aging process quite enough to match yours. After a certain point, it begins to go very quickly with us. Even if it were not for the illness, you know this already, you can see it. but you don't seem old enough to give everything up, Ludwig. He gave me a look of intense, blurred sadness and then picked up the remains of a lemon slice from his saucer and held it absent-mindedly in his hand. One would not willingly give everything up, he said, but the time comes. Also, he said, there would be no point in living if I were entirely mad. But you wouldn't ever kill yourself, would you? What difference does it make? Of course, I would have to do it before I lost my mind completely. Afterward, I would not be able to. Perhaps I would not remember that I had meant to. So in that sense, I suppose some time would be lost. You can't do that, I said. Ludwig smiled again, in a secret, bitter way that I didn't like. You wouldn't be able to prevent me. But Cleo, why must we talk about this? Even if it were to happen, it would be far in the future.
Kirsten Backus, reading from her novel Lives of the Monster Dogs. Doug Gordon talked with her.